Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. Aftermath. Emergency response teams in Florida rush to help those hardest hit by Hurricane Ian, while the storm wreaks more havoc with a second landfall in the Carolinas. Then land grab. Russia annexes territories in southern and eastern Ukraine after staging sham referendums. And it's Friday. David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart analyze the state and federal response to Hurricane Ian and recent election victories by right-wing political parties across Europe. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. Hurricane Ian is back on shore tonight and weakening to a tropical storm after its second landfall on the U.S. mainland. The storm struck near Georgetown, South Carolina this afternoon with winds of 85 miles an hour, heavy rain and surging waves. In its wake, officials in Florida confirmed at least 17 are dead, with vast scenes of wreckage along the state's southwestern coastline. John Yang begins our coverage again from Sarasota, Florida.
A Coast Guard rescue team lands on Sanibel Island, still covered by several feet of water and isolated because the only bridge connecting it to the mainland collapsed as Ian came ashore. The team tells a couple to pack a bag of essentials. As they're lifted to safety, the woman clings to her cat tucked into its carrier. It's one of more than 700 rescues across Southwest and Central Florida in Ian's aftermath. Stephen King wrote out the storm on San Carlos Island.
And when it got to there, the way they were saying on the news, I thought it was going to eventually go over our heads. I called my daughters and said goodbye. Next time, we'll know to get the hell out.
Ed McCrane has run Sarasota County's emergency services for 17 years.
So you'll notice the signs of logistics.
This is probably the worst type of storm that I've seen in my career. And I've been through, you know, Katrina, Ivan, those, but this one was intense. I think they're going to end up classifying this as one of the most dangerous and largest in the history.
The work of McCrane's team didn't end when Ian moved on from Southwest Florida.
We transitioned from responding to recovery. We're still responding because we're bringing in food and water. We're doing search and rescue operations, but we're coordinating for resources.
Before and after photos dramatically illustrate the destruction Ian caused in Fort Myers, leveling homes and wiping out entire communities. For residents returning to the city, the loss is palpable.
We just got here and this is what we found. We've only been here for 6 months. We just pulled off our money to buy it and it's gone 6 months later.
Tyler Hallman placed his waterlogged family photo albums in the sun to dry.
Everything was submerged. We had probably 3 or 4 feet of water inside the house.
At the White House, President Biden expressed the nation's sympathies.
The situation in Florida is far more devastating. We're just beginning to see the scale of that destruction. It's likely to rank among the worst in the nation's history. It's going to take months, years to rebuild. And our hearts go out to all those folks whose lives have been absolutely devastated by this storm. America's heart is literally breaking.
High water remains a problem throughout Southwest Florida, and officials say it could get worse in the coming days. That's because all that rain that got dumped on Central Florida is going to be carried by rivers down to this region. Rebuilding lives won't be easy. At one point today, 1.9 million people across the state were still without power. Many of them relied on gasoline-powered generators, but gas is hard to come by.
Yes. I've been waiting for about 2.5 hours, almost 3 hours, in line for gas.
In South Carolina, heavy rains hit the coast as Ian made its second landfall.
It looks like it's going to be less than what's happened in Florida, but you never know.
Residents there will be hunkering down for a long night. At Sarasota County's Emergency Management Center in Florida, Director Ed McCrane knows he can't let his guard down.
This is 30 September. We have all of October and all of November to remain under the hurricane season. We're not taking our eyes off the Atlantic. There could be another system that pops up.
This has been a very quiet year in some people's minds until this. It only takes one, and this was our one.
This operation center has been staffed 24 hours a day, two 12-hour shifts since this past weekend. And the director says he expects it to remain up and running for some time to come, though not necessarily around the clock, as the long recovery effort continues. Judy?
John, thank you. I want to ask you also, we've been seeing reports about a significant number of nursing homes, assisted living facilities that have had to be evacuated. Do we know how many there are and what's their status?
The officials of the Florida Healthcare Association, which represents nursing homes, say that there are about 8,000 residents who have been evacuated, mostly in southwestern Florida, because of the wind damage, because of the storm surge, but also some in central Florida and eastern Florida because of the torrential rain and flooding. Some of these places don't have running water, some don't have power, and some are damaged structurally.
And John, do we know what the plans are with regard to bringing them back to where they were and what they're doing in the meantime and how that's all being managed?
A lot of them are in evacuation centers, and the Florida Healthcare Association notes that their caregivers have sort of embedded with them, have remained with them and gone with them, even though their homes may have been damaged and withstood the brunt of Ian. There are about 78 nursing homes without power, but have generators that are still in operation. That's a state law here in Florida that all long-term care facilities have generators, and that once a state of emergency is declared, they have 96 hours of fuel on hand. And also a number of the nursing homes that don't have running water are looking at bringing in water trucks so they can get the residents back in their familiar surroundings as quickly as possible.
Well, the challenges just seem to be endless wherever you look. John Yang reporting for us from Sarasota. Thank you, John. Let's talk further about some of the relief efforts that are beginning to get underway. Evan Peterson is with the American Red Cross, and he joins me from Orlando. Welcome to you, Mr. Peterson. So tell us, what are you and your colleagues dealing with? What are you going to be having to do in the days to come?
Well, it is kind of at a moment right now where we're all kind of coming out of our shelters and figuring out what exactly happened, how much damage has there been. We've been here since before the storm, making sure that we have resources and people at the ready so that when the time comes that we're not providing that immediate safety and those immediate needs, we can start transitioning towards long-term recovery. Right now, we're slowly beginning that process. We've been in constant communication with our government liaisons, municipalities, emergency management services, all across the state of Florida, but as well as South Carolina and Georgia, making sure that when they need help, when they need us to help respond, we are able to do so. In fact, last night we had 10,000 people staying at a variety of Red Cross and partner shelters, about 100 in total. So right now, that's the name of the game, beginning that pivot, assessing damage, and making sure we're developing that plan to help people make that long-term recovery help.
What do you think the greatest need is going to be, first in Florida, where it certainly appears the worst impact of this storm has been felt?
I think right now it might be a little too early to say what the greatest need is going to be. Ahead of this storm, we moved in tens of thousands of different kinds of disaster supplies to help people, including hundreds of blood products. But right now, when people have been asking me, what is the best way that I can contribute to what the Red Cross is doing and helping people, I tell them this: if you have a blood appointment on the books right now, please keep that blood appointment. We, again, moved hundreds of products down here ahead of the storm so that when emergency responders need to reach for that type O, they're able to do so. It's going to be on their shelves, but we need to keep that supply open.
So I can see you're looking for donations. So at this point, do you have any sense of where the greatest need will be in the Florida area?
all across the state of Florida is where we're going to be using this money to help us address this. But obviously right now, when we hear meteorologists, when we hear Hurricane Center meteorologists say that this is a catastrophic flood, I think right now we're looking to that west coast of Florida, the Fort Myers area, first, one of the first places that comes to mind, because that's where we're seeing a lot of damage, storm surge, millions of people without power. So it's going to be put to use everywhere impacted by Ian, but right now our attention is on those hardest hit places.
Well, clearly looking at a long recovery to come. Evan Peterson with the American Red Cross joining us from Orlando. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
As we've been hearing, the flooding is so bad in some Florida communities that relief agencies and others are having trouble getting to some of the hardest hit areas. That includes many journalists, including our team. Wendy Powell is one of the local reporters who stayed to report on the storm and its aftermath. She's the editor of the Naples Daily News, and she and her colleagues are working in a makeshift newsroom in Fort Myers, and she joins me now. So, Wendy Powell, what are you dealing with in the Naples-Fort Myers area right now in terms of what you have to cover?
We are dealing with mass devastation. We have islands that have been disconnected from the mainland. The island of Sanibel, the causeway collapsed into the bay, and so there is absolutely no way to get on that island. Fort Myers Beach is another island where it's absolute. We've seen pictures, and we haven't physically. We've had people on the island, but we have not been able to get on there. The devastation is just beyond what I've ever seen in my entire career.
What are you seeing in terms of the human situation, where people are? Are people stranded? Do you know any more about need for either hospital or medical help that people have right now?
We know that they're still doing search and rescue efforts. We actually had a reporter that took a boat ride out to Captiva Island and was on the boat with three of the last people that were rescued from that island. We had reporters and photographers that were on jet skis today trying to get out to another island to see what the situation was there. There is no power, the supplies. Some of the gas stations started returning to operating, and the lines are just around the corner backing up to interstates. And so the frustration level for those that are only without the power and connectivity, but then there are just so many people that have lost absolutely everything. And it's truly, truly a devastating situation.
It sounds just almost unimaginable. And we heard you say this is the worst you have ever seen. Is it your sense, Wendy Powell, that the relief efforts that people are going to need are going to be there? We just heard the gentleman from the Red Cross say they are still collecting information before they can even go out and do anything.
They absolutely are. The islands have been substantially cut off for the most part. We were on a boat where they were bringing some supplies out to a couple of the islands. The rescue efforts, the relief teams that are here are from all over the country, including actually outside of the country. And so they are here ready to help. We've been watching as the Coast Guard has been in there and flying people out and landing them at shelter properties around Southwest Florida. First have to go in there and do some of the cleanup. One of our eyewitnesses that was on Fort Myers Beach compared the levels of sand that were scooped off of the main road, sort of like the aftermath of a snowstorm, where you see those piles of snow at the bottom of a hill. And so they're doing the best, absolute best that they can at this point. It's going to be frustrating. It's not going to be a quick recovery for anybody. Our journalists alone have been impacted, have lost homes. So they're dealing with that as well.
Well, it certainly does sound overwhelming. We thank you so much for talking with us, Wendy Powell of the Naples Daily News.
Thank you.
In the day's other news, Russia's President Vladimir Putin sharply escalated the war in Ukraine, signing treaties to illegally annex four regions. He vowed to defend the newly seized territory by, quote, all available means. Meanwhile, Russian fire rained down on Ukrainian cities, killing 30 people in Zaporizhia. We'll have a detailed report after the news summary. The war in Ukraine has sent natural gas prices and overall inflation soaring across the European Union. New numbers today show the EU's inflation ran at 10% in September, compared with prices a year ago. In Brussels, EU energy ministers approved a windfall profits tax on fossil fuel companies, but they could not agree on curbing gas prices.
I believe we could impose a price cap on all Russian imported gas, including LNG. However, some member states see this as a sanction, and we don't yet have a consensus on this step.
Germany has been a leading opponent of capping prices over concerns that it could limit gas supplies. A suicide bomber in Afghanistan attacked an educational center in Kabul today, killing 19 people and wounding nearly 30. It happened in a Shiite area as hundreds of teenage students were taking practice entrance exams for college. Some of the students were among the dead. There was no immediate claim of responsibility. Rare public protests have broken out in Cuba over lingering power outages from Hurricane Ian. The storm caused an island-wide blackout this week, and some areas are still in the dark. Overnight, several hundred people protested in Havana, demanding power be restored. They banged pots and pans, started fires, and complained that their food is spoiling.
This isn't working. Enough of this. All my food is rotten. Why? Because we don't have electricity, and this will not last anymore. This does not work, brother.
Cuban utility officials say only about 10% of Havana's 2 million people had electricity as of Thursday. Back in this country, Congress gave final approval to a short-term spending bill to avoid a partial government shutdown this weekend. It will finance federal agencies into mid-December, and it also includes military and economic aid for Ukraine. President Biden later signed it into law. On Wall Street, major stock indexes finished a miserable month. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was down another 500 points today to close at 28,725. The Nasdaq fell nearly 162 points. The S&P 500 slid almost 55. For the month, the Dow and the S&P lost nearly 9% or more. That is their worst September in 20 years. The Nasdaq slid 10.5%. That's the most since September of 2008. And Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson had her ceremonial induction today as the first black woman on the U.S. Supreme Court. President Biden and Vice President Harris attended the brief investiture ceremony. Jackson had been confirmed by the Senate in April and formally joined the high court in June. The court begins its new term on Monday. Still to come on the NewsHour, what's at stake as Brazilians prepare to vote in a highly divisive presidential election. David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart consider the week's political news. Two Ukrainian artists who cannot return home form a new community in the U.S., plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
In a grand ceremony at the Kremlin today, Russia's President Vladimir Putin signed papers to formally but illegally annex four regions in Ukraine, an area the size of Ohio, after what the West calls sham referendums. The U.S. and allies responded with tougher sanctions and reiterated their support for Ukraine. That all happened at the same time as one of Russia's deadliest strikes on civilians. Nick Schifrin begins our coverage.
Today's reality, the body of a Ukrainian civilian killed by a Russian rocket. Today's alternate reality, a Red Square celebration of conquest, a euphoric concert marking Russian annexation. Reality, Ukrainian soldiers re-seizing their own territory from Russian occupiers. Alternate reality, a hand-picked audience cheers Russian President Vladimir Putin's calling today a day of truth and justice. And yet, today's formal annexation signing with the four Russian-appointed leaders of Ukrainian districts is the war's largest escalation since invasion.
We will defend our land using all forces and means at our disposal, and we'll do everything we can to protect the security of our people.
And to an ecstatic audience of elites, Putin rallied against the West and what he defined as its culture.
To maintain its unlimited power is the real reason for the hybrid war that the collective West is waging against Russia. Do we really want in our schools, from the elementary grades, that children are taught that besides a man and a woman, there are other genders? Such a rejection of faith and traditional values begins to look like a perverted religion, outright Satanism.
Putin raised his nuclear rhetoric by recalling U.S. attacks on World War II Japan.
The United States is the only country in the world to use nuclear weapons twice, destroying the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Actually, they set a precedent.
Putin's actions are a sign he's struggling. The sham referenda he carried out.
In response, President Biden vowed never to respect any Russian claim to Ukrainian land.
He can't seize his neighbor's territory and get away with it. It's as simple as that.
And the U.S. government sanctioned more than 1,000 Russian people and companies, including Elvira Nabiullina, Russia's central bank governor who's helped the Russian economy survive, almost 300 Russian lawmakers, family members of Russia's National Security Council, Russians accused of torturing Ukrainians, and Russian military procurement officials.
Порядку в НАТО.
President Volodymyr Zelensky used today to formally apply for an accelerated plan to become a NATO member, and he ruled out negotiations with Putin.
It is obvious that this is impossible with this Russian president. He does not know what dignity and honesty are. Therefore, we are ready for a dialogue with Russia, but with a different president of Russia.
National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said Ukraine's NATO membership should be, quote, taken up at a different time. But Putin's nuclear threats top the administration's current concerns.
There is a risk, given all of the loose talk and the nuclear saber-rattling by Putin, that he would consider this. And we've been equally clear about what the consequences would be.
And to examine Putin's nuclear threats and annexation announcement today and where all this leaves the war, I'm joined by Fiona Hill, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Fiona Hill, thank you very much. Welcome back to the NewsHour. The Kremlin, of course, has faced battlefield setbacks in the last few days and weeks. Putin recently has been criticized by China and India. What do you think is the context for why Putin is announcing annexation today?
Well, it's clear to change the entire nature of the battlefield. What he's done in annexing this territory is basically transform this into a defensive war rather than an offensive war, at least certainly rhetorically. I mean, of course, you know, this is completely illegitimate, but he's now saying that these territories are, in fact, part of Russia. In fact, he said part of Russia forever. And that, therefore, any kind of attack on the territories of the Kherson and Zaporizhia regions, as well as any of the territories in the Donbass, and even further afield to Crimea, will now be seen as an attack on Russia itself. And his hope, then, is that the call-up of Russian troops, the mobilization that we've seen over the last several days, this partial mobilization, will in fact encourage now people to the battlefield. We won't be seeing so much of these defections because people will realize that they're in this all-out battle, he's said, with the West, not just with Ukraine, and this is a battle for Russia's survival. So he's really taken it up several notches, and he's therefore justifying any kind of action against the West.
Of course, you just said any kind of action, and he brandished what Jake Sullivan today called nuclear saber-rattling. Putin said the U.S. had created, quote, the precedent of using nuclear weapons. Sullivan said that the U.S. is taking it very seriously. How serious do you think Putin is?
I think taking that on the rhetorical level, where he's been very serious about creating this framing there, I think we have to take this to the court of international reaction. In other words, take this to the United Nations and get pushback here as well. But we have to take this threat seriously. Putin is always the kind of person that when he threatens something, he wants to deliver on it. So we should take that seriously. But I think we should also be very seriously engaged in diplomacy now to push back and to point out how outrageous not just his statements are, but some of the claims and the distortions of history.
As you just said, the push on diplomacy, of course, would require Ukraine And Zelensky, as we heard earlier, said he would be happy to negotiate with Russia once Putin was no longer president. There are no negotiations today, and there's not much of a chance on either side for negotiations. But does Zelensky's statement and the annexation forestall or further forestall any possibility for diplomacy to end this war?
It doesn't forestall diplomacy at all. But I think what it does make very difficult, of course, is some kind of negotiated compromise settlement. Putin's basically saying there is no room for compromise. We've just annexed this territory. It's going to be Russia's in perpetuity. He's also got his eyes on a further extension of the military conflict. I mean, we've seen throughout all of the period since 2014, Russia used to talk about this idea of Nova Russia, new Russia, which also includes Odessa. We've seen attacks on Odessa. We've seen threats against Moldova, the country next to Ukraine, for example. That might also fall under this rubric of new Russia. And he repeated new Russia several times during the speech. So the point here is that he's basically saying, I'm not going to negotiate on the basis of this territory that I've taken. He's basically wanting to have Ukraine negotiate for the terms of its surrender. This is the largest annexation since World War II. It's turned the whole global strategic balance on its head, and there has to be then a commensurate international reaction. So I think that's where the next phase of our diplomacy has to be focused, which is getting other countries worldwide to push back on this act that Vladimir Putin has undertaken today.
And finally, the pipelines that take natural gas from Russia into Europe exploded earlier this week. Today, President Biden said the damage was, quote, deliberate act of sabotage. Jake Sullivan said that there were very few countries capable of such an act of sabotage, but that the damage was, quote, not caused by a NATO country. Do you believe Russia would have sabotaged their own pipelines?
Actually, I do, especially given one element in the speech today, which I was watching very closely. Putin talks about, he calls the UK and the United States, the Anglo-Saxons together, and suggests that the UK and the United States might have done this as a diversion, blowing up the pipelines, and as he says then, rupturing the whole edifice of European energy security. And then he says, well, people speculate on who does this benefit? And then he smirks. And you can see this because the camera in the Kremlin auditorium base homed in just as he said this and caught the smirk on his face. It's almost like he couldn't stop himself from smirking. And he says, well, of course, the person who benefits is the person who did it. And it made it very clear to me that this was ordered by the Kremlin. But what he doesn't mention is, of course, that he is basically continuing to export oil. So that's the next front to be mindful of. Putin always does something when he, like this, something destructive when he thinks that he can leverage something else.
Fiona Hill of the Brookings Institution, thank you very much.
Thanks, Nick.
Brazilians go to the polls Sunday in a hotly contested election that has drawn the world's attention. Voters will decide whether to re-elect their right-wing president, Jair Bolsonaro, or return the twice-elected former president, known to everyone as Lula, to power. In partnership with the Pulitzer Center, special correspondent Jane Ferguson reports from the Atlantic coast state of Bahia, north of Rio.
It takes a strong person to survive the slums, known as favelas, of Panama City. On top of crushing poverty and crime, people must fight just to keep a roof over their heads. Under the government of Jair Bolsonaro these last 4 years, efforts by farmers and land developers to push the poor off unoccupied lands, often with violence, have increased.
Terrible.
It's terrible because he armed the land speculators. They say that we are troublemakers, invaders, and they arm the farmers and say that we don't have the right to land.
Nildes Araújo leads the fight to defend her home, this small patch of land she shares with 60 families living in tiny makeshift houses. She works with a land rights organization, and after speculators sent gunmen to chase them away, Araújo got a lawyer, went to court, and won the right to stay for now.
These conflicts have always occurred, but with the Bolsonaro government, it worsened because they do not give us the right to housing. And if it were up to him, we were all on the street.
Millions of Brazilians live in favelas on land they don't own or rent because they cannot afford to. Residents connect illegally to local power and water sources, and the areas are often blighted by gang violence. But there are few other options for the country's vast population living in poverty. Marinesh Andrade lived on the streets for most of her life before Araújo helped her come here. Her organization gave Andrade this small wooden home to live in 4 years ago. The memory of life on the streets is still painful for her.
I have suffered for 58 years. My whole life has been suffering. I used to beg by the church, and I had to hide my children when they were small so they wouldn't get killed.
Andrade will vote on Sunday for Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, known to everyone as Lula. President from 2003 to 2010, left-wing Workers' Party chief Lula was jailed on corruption charges 8 years after his presidency, charges that were later overturned. In a sweeping comeback, he is now the front-runner in Sunday's presidential election. His opponent, the populist incumbent president Jair Bolsonaro, is trailing in the polls. Bolsonaro came to power in 2018 amidst economic and political turmoil in Brazil, with a right-wing, often combative message of God, family values, and fervent nationalism. In this favela, his message does not resonate. Maria Farias has only ever voted for the Workers' Party.
Who are you going to be voting for on Sunday?
Lula, do 13.
Lula, no hesitation. Did you vote for Lula the last time before?
Always. My vote was for him every time, ever since he ran. Lula, 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 until I die.
The social programs Lula put in place have had a direct impact on her family.
Because of Lula, my daughter got a full scholarship to a private school. We didn't have to pay anything, and now she has a degree and works as a teacher. I am very grateful to the Lula government, and my husband managed to get a car too.
But that is exactly what bothers Aldo Teles, farmer from the central region of Mato Grosso.
His majority works very little, produces very little. It's not about giving things away. The spirit of the Workers' Party is to give things away to left-wing people. Those people do not get out of misery. They are always captive to vote for them.
Teles lives in Bolsonaro territory, a farming community resentful of land distributions to the indigenous people and left-wing government handouts to the urban poor.
The problem is that Lula is left-wing. You must be aware of the problems in Venezuela, the problems in Argentina now, and so many others that are doomed to failure. Lula doesn't think about teaching people how to fish. He thinks about giving the fish away. What generates wealth, what generates work, is production. And if you just give things away, what will happen? The country would be in chaos. That is our fear.
Chaos might be coming regardless. Bolsonaro has for months questioned the election results, casting doubt in the electronic voting system of Brazil and praising Brazil's military dictatorship that ran the country from 1964 to 1985. Fears have grown that he may refuse to concede if he does not win, claiming instead that the vote was rigged. The head of the CIA, Bill Burns, reportedly warned Bolsonaro last year to respect the democratic process, and lawmakers in the US and Europe have underlined that they will quickly move to recognize the election results.
Every Bolsonaro supporter we spoke to said that A, they do not listen to journalists, they don't read the papers or watch television news, and that B, they get their information from social media and encrypted messaging services like WhatsApp. As a result, they all say that despite what the polls say, they are confident of a sweeping Bolsonaro victory on Sunday.
His campaign has convinced many of his supporters that if he doesn't win, it's because the voting system is corrupt. To farmers like Celso Nogueira, it will be a fair election only if Bolsonaro wins it.
Bolsonaro has already proven this when we brought people from outside several countries to show that the polls are only fraudulent. If we have a clean election for both of us in the middle of Sunday, October 2nd, we will have a very clear win for Bolsonaro. The population doesn't want Lula.
Brazilian political analyst and author Marcos Nobre says this brand of populism is new here.
This is completely different because, for one thing, it's far-right populism. And in this sense, he was able to circumvent the usual gatekeepers in the media. And he was able to convince some groups that felt underrepresented that going with him would change everything.
If all this sounds familiar, it should. Bolsonaro has been widely praised by former President Trump, and Bolsonaro's circle are known to have close connections with former Trump strategists like Steve Bannon.
We still don't know if this movement will organize itself as a movement, like an international authoritarian movement. But what we know is that they have connections and they exchange information and techniques.
Not all who are planning to vote for Bolsonaro are diehard supporters. As Brazilian politics becomes even more polarized, the options for those voting on Sunday are far on either end of the political spectrum.
We don't want to have a president of the extreme right nor of the extreme left. We would like to have a center president who wishes the good of the entire population, because we are experiencing a very dangerous moment in Brazil.
There is a growing realization in Brazil that politics here has fundamentally changed. The increasing polarization and angry rhetoric has many on edge. As Brazilians use their right to vote on Sunday, their country's democracy feels increasingly fragile. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jane Ferguson in Chuapa, Brazil.
As Hurricane Ian leaves a swath of death and destruction in its wake, it also has the potential to affect politics as we near the November elections. To discuss this and more of the week's news, we turn to the analysis of Brooks and Capehart. That's New York Times columnist David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart, associate editor for The Washington Post. Hello to both of you. It's Friday. Thank you for being here. And I do want to start, Jonathan, with this awful storm that we are very focused on, and rightly should be. Ian, it has worked its way across Florida, causing death and destruction, now landfall in the Carolinas. It taxing resources of government at every level. We don't know what that's ultimately going to be. But there are, as we just said, political consequences to this. We've seen our leaders in the past handle them well, not handle them well. Mm-hmm. What's at stake? Can the country handle this? What's at stake for these leaders?
Well, so far it seems like the leaders are doing what they are supposed to be doing, and that is tending to the needs of the people. That's the president declaring a disaster in Florida, working, surprisingly, with the governor, the Republican governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis, to bring aid to the state of Florida. The governor of Florida, who has spent a lot of time criticizing the president and the White House and Democrats, but when it comes to focusing on the people of Florida, he has nothing but kind words. So I think in terms of doing the job that needs to be done, they're both doing the right thing. The politics of it all, again, Governor DeSantis is running for re-election. So he's got to focus on the people of Florida and put politics aside. He even said as much on Fox News.
What are the pitfalls at this point? You have, as Jonathan said, the Governor DeSantis clearly eyeing or thinking about running for president. Then you have President Biden going down there in a few days.
Yeah, I think what's happening is we're focusing on people. I mean, there have been so many interviews with, I just saw an interview with a couple who stayed in their home. They were terrified and they fled as homes around them were dissolving and he was killed, she survived. Couples, you know, I saw a couple in a life raft in their living room, mm-hmm. rising as the water levels rise, watching all their goods be destroyed. And so when you focus on human beings and you, it does take you a little out of the political.
For sure.
And so, and I've been impressed in the reporting on this program and elsewhere that the locals seem to be doing their jobs. You get the sense in interview after interview of competence. And so it, to me, it has an effect of making me feel a little better about the country in hard circumstances, that we came together a little as so far as Jonathan said, and then that people are really active and responding from all around the country, from all around the world, helping out. And I think the final, mostly political point is DeSantis is no Trump. That Trump, if you remember in these circumstances, could not show compassion, could not stop having the culture war. And DeSantis can turn that off, and he can behave like a normal governor.
And we are, as Jonathan, and we've been covering climate change, we're going to be seeing more and more of these climate disasters, calling on political leadership, but also the resources that governments are going to have to spend to clean up, to restore life to what people deserve.
Right. Well, restore, at this point, it's got to be not just restoring, but improving so that when the next, you know, once in a 100-year storm comes by in week two after a previous one, that folks can survive, that the structures can survive. We're looking at more severe storms happening much more frequently. This storm, Hurricane Ian, you know, coming through the coast, raking across Florida, ramping back up in the Atlantic, raking across the Carolinas. You've got people and politicians who are looking around and thinking, how do we address these things? Yeah. How do we address the climate? How do we repair? But then the other big question becomes, where does all the money come from? And that is the key thing, that if Washington doesn't get its act together and start doing things more boldly to address climate change, then addressing the climate is super expensive. Repairing and restoring communities after they've been decimated for the fifth or sixth time is even more expensive.
I mean, and there is this divide, David, about what to do about climate change right now.
Yeah, I'm old enough to remember when Republicans talked about climate change, including John McCain and Lindsey Graham.
Me too.
Yeah. And it got turned partisan like everything else. And globally, it's just a big collective action problem where the costs of addressing climate change are right now, but the benefits are long term. But now, if we get more natural disasters, the costs are also short term. And so you see this logic where people are saying, you know, we just can't afford not to do it. And whether that will kick in, I confess I'm not too optimistic with China being where it is, but you can't help not be startled by the weather patterns.
You can't. And watching this terrible, as you say, human aftermath in Florida and perhaps elsewhere has to get everyone's attention. To Europe, we don't often talk about politics overseas, but it has come to our attention this week. Jonathan, with the election of a woman named Giorgia Meloni, she's the leader of the Brothers of Italy, a political party, has ushered in what is being described as the most far-right government in Italy since World War II. And this is just a few days after Sweden showed, or a few weeks, I should say, after Sweden showed a relatively high vote for a right-leaning party there. What does this portend? How worried should the rest of the West be?
Well, I mean, I think the West should be worried. I mean, Italy has had its fascist past, and Giorgia Meloni says that, you know, don't worry, I'm not like that kind of fascist. I'm not a fascist. Don't worry. But I remember at the Aspen Ideas Festival, I think it was in 2016, Newt Gingrich gave a presentation talking about the populist right-leaning movements that were happening around the world. And he marched all the way across the globe, and Brexit was the big story. And then there was the 2016 presidential election here in the United States. And he predicted then that Donald Trump would win, and that would be part of this global march to the right. Well, we're seeing it, that march still happening. There's not just Giorgia Meloni in Italy and what's happened in Sweden, but let's not forget Duda in Poland, yeah. Orban in Hungary. This move towards either authoritarianism or autocracy or turning to the far right. And the fact that this has happened in Italy, a NATO member, is just another, it's just another pressure point in what President Biden has been talking about. You know, democracy has to prove that it can deliver. And right now, whether it's in Sweden, Italy, Hungary, Poland, you name it, a lot of people aren't so sure about democracy, and they're looking to far right or authoritarian figures who are about exclusion as opposed to bringing folks together.
How concerned do you think the West should be?
Well, the West should be concerned about immigration. In Italy and Sweden, immigration is the top issue, as it was for Donald Trump, as it is for a lot of these other. The Swedes have a higher immigration rate as a percentage of population than we do, which is, you know, we're the nation of immigrants. And so if you don't get your immigration under control, a lot of people are going to be upset. And it should be a big message for Joe Biden. got to control the borders. Americans like immigration, but they want controlled borders. And if you don't do it, in countries where you don't do it, the center-left collapses. The second thing is that there was a Maloney video that went viral this week of her saying, here are my identities. I'm an Italian, I'm a woman, I'm a mother, I'm a Christian, and those people are out to destroy every one of my identities. And that is sort of the cultural message that all these different conservative movements have. And even, you know, even Vladimir Putin, you know, talking about gender changing in the middle of a war. And so the cultural element is not to be underestimated. And I would say it's cohering, the cultural critique of modernism, of cosmopolitanism, whatever you want to call it, urbanism, it's cohering around the world. And we see it in almost every Western country.
And gives us pause.
Yeah.
Gives us pause. Finally, Jonathan, this week we saw something we weren't sure was going to happen, and that was Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, his wife Virginia Thomas, Ginny Thomas, testifying before the January 6th committee, and the chairman, Benny Thompson, came out later and said what she said, among other things, is that she does believe today that the 2020 presidential election was stolen, that Donald Trump actually won. What does that say?
It's shocking. We are almost 2 years after the 2020 presidential election, an election that Donald Trump's own cybersecurity expert, before he fired him, said was the fairest and safest election, presidential election, probably in American history. The myths and about election fraud, all of those things have been debunked. And yet here's this person who is a leader in the conservative movement, even before this, is still clinging to this notion that the election was stolen from Donald Trump. It's a lie. It's a reason it's called a big lie, and yet she still holds on to it. And the problem with that, in addition to her believing that, it's who she's married to. A Supreme Court justice who didn't recuse himself from a case earlier involving Donald Trump. There could be other cases involving Donald Trump. And the question and the pressure will be on Justice Thomas to recuse and the, personally, but pressure on the Supreme Court to do something to hold justices accountable for things like that.
How significant?
Well, it is a lie, as Jonathan said. She's wrong. She's always been sort of on the fringy, sort of avant-garde of the right, even when back when the right was a little more normal than it is.
And you can explain what that is.
I don't know. There was a Lee Atwater phrase for a certain kind of conservative. He helped ran the Reagan campaign.
Yeah.
There are some people who have forearms growing out of their foreheads. He would say that. He went sort of the... I don't know, the far edge, and she's always been a little over there. The question is, should Justice Thomas recuse? I'd be a little hesitant to go there. I don't think the opinions of a family member of Supreme Court justice, I think the justices are careful enough not to let that influence their jurisprudence. And finally, you know, she claimed that they don't talk about the decisions. I don't know. I'm not on their pillow, so I don't know. I do not. I do know couples in Washington that... are in security jobs, top secret jobs, and they literally don't talk about work at home. Yeah. And so it's possible.
It's possible. Possible. Something for us to think about for days to come. David Brooks, Jonathan Capehart, thank you for giving us something to think about.
Thanks.
Thank you.
The humanitarian crisis caused by the war in Ukraine extends far beyond its borders. Days before the war started in February, two Ukrainian artists boarded a plane for Tennessee to exhibit their work and teach workshops. 7 months later, they are still not able to return home. WTCI PBS in Chattanooga tells the story of this resilient couple and the support they've received halfway around the world. It's part of our arts and culture coverage. Canvas.
My name is Victoria Kalechi. My husband Denise and I are artists from Ukraine.
We got connected to Denis and Victoria probably about 4 or 5 years ago. The proposal was for us to have a show, and then we would also have a workshop taught by Victoria with Denis co-teaching.
Everybody was talking about the family. that came to Chattanooga to participate in an art exchange.
We left Kharkiv for Kyiv on February 22nd. Without suspecting anything, we arrived in Chattanooga. And at that moment, I connected to Wi-Fi, and I received a picture from my father as he was pulling up to a gas station. And on the horizon were explosions and black smoke. Everything was clear what was happening.
Everything turned upside down. Everything changed in an instant. Our plans, our entire life changed.
Nobody knows when they can become a refugee. You know, it's such an unpredictable situation. These are people who never did anything wrong. Just external circumstances put them in extreme situation.
We're seeing in real time our city being bombed, our neighborhood. It feels as though 10 of my closest relatives died at the same time. And it's such a tragedy. I paint because I cannot not paint. It's somewhere I can escape, where I feel safe. It's somewhere where I can escape from the real problems in the world.
Life becomes before and after. You start thinking about those who are left behind in Ukraine. And here, in a peaceful environment, you see people walking on the street, smiling, going to restaurants, just living their normal lives.
You know, imagine preparing for a year and a half for a solo show and to teach a sold-out workshop. We had people from all over the country coming to take this workshop with her and Dennis. They have to attend an opening and teach and deal with the shock and the horror and all of the emotions of being away from home.
I knew that they know how to deal with it because we know that art is healing.
It was so amazing how many people came to the opening in support of Ukraine. People were wearing yellow and blue and in support of Dennis and Victoria. We started a GoFundMe, and we raised like $17,000 in like a week. And then people would drop by checks. People would drop by gift baskets. People would come by and drop by all of this stuff, call and say, hey, do you need a studio? Do you need a place to live? So every time Dennis and Victoria would come here, I had something to give them.
I'm just very grateful for people of our community to offer an opportunity for Ukrainians to wait out this terrible situation where they are met with welcoming hands, open hearts, where they're loved, where they understood.
My gratitude is just endless for every person who even thought of us and whose heart responded to help us.
It restores this idea of faith in people, that people can help each other and create, not just destroy. You begin to believe in people again and understand that, yes, there are bad people, but there are good people too, and there are a lot of them.
Heartwarming in what they have been through. And that report from WTCI PBS in Chattanooga. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.